What number is this, Chip?
Episode 12, the Monkey See, Monkey Die commentary, an interview with Fred Velez, and more.
Okay, no, I mean, like, don't get excited, man. It's because I'm short. I know.
You're listening to Zilch, a Monkeys podcast.
And we welcome you once again to another episode of Zilch. And as always, we are glad that you're spending some of your valuable time with us. I'm joined with the ever-wonderful Jeff Hewlett.
How's it going, everybody?
And the ever-wonderful Craig Cohen.
Oh, wow. Thank you very much. That's very kind of you, Ken.
How are we doing today, guys?
Oh, excellent. Hey, any time that we are able to come here and monkey around with you, it's a good time.
Awesome. Absolutely. Awesome. Love it. Well, why don't we hop into the monkey's mailbag? Cue the music.
P.O. Box 9847.
And here's one from the monkey's mailbag. No Shades of Gray Here. This is Awesome by Todd Inlow. For 28 years, there have been very few people I can talk with any depth to about the monkeys. I have found a new home here with Zilch. Only discovered it a few days ago, so I'm binge listening. Remember, stay calm and keep monkeying around. I guess Todd Inlow likes us.
Oh, that's excellent. It's always great to hear those great five-star reviews.
You know, it would be really cool if we could see our fans face to face.
Oh, yeah.
That would be cool.
What's up, Ken?
Not much, Bugs.
Nobody here but us monkeys fans.
Then why don't we make some friends?
Hey, let's make some Kool-Aid.
Make friends with Kool-Aid. Far from that never ends. Get together with Kool-Aid. It's a taste to try. Get together with Kool-Aid. Side to side. Make friends with Kool-Aid. Kool-Aid makes friends. Make friends with Kool-Aid. For fun that never ends. Never ends.
You can always use another friend.
You sure can. Thanks, Bugs. Well, as we enjoy this wonderful glass of Kool-Aid, let's catch up on what you guys have been up to. We all went on our little vacations. I went to Gatlinburg, and you guys went to Vegas.
Yeah.
Why don't you tell us a little bit about that?
In late July, early August. Perfect time to go to the middle of the desert.
110 degrees plus.
Well, you could always use some Kool-Aid, so it's good we have some.
Well, we were out there sort of on assignment for our other podcast, the Tricorder Transmissions, and they had the annual Star Trek convention.
Awesome.
Yeah, and we had so many things that we had planned ahead of time. This was kind of an action-packed tour. So we were meeting up with different celebrities for photo ops and meeting. And we actually wound up meeting up with a couple of our own listeners while we were out there, which was incredible.
Yeah.
I myself am deeply jealous.
Why is that?
No, that's a monkey's line. I just quoted the show. That sounds amazingly wonderful. That is so cool. And you guys got to hang out with...
George Pappy. Yeah. So, he's the director, the visionary behind the Green Girl, which was a documentary about Susan Oliver, the actress Susan Oliver, who appeared in so many TV series in the 60s and 70s, 80s and beyond. And we were fortunate enough to be part of a screening of the Green Girl documentary out in Las Vegas.
Yeah, and it really is of interest to anybody who's a fan of 1960s and 1970s TV. The sort of gateway to the documentary is Susan's appearance as Vina in The Cage and The Menagerie Part 1 and 2. It's really just the gateway, and in addition to taking us through her career, her amazing career that spilled out of acting into aviation, into directing, it really is the story of a fascinating woman. And you also get to see all of these amazing clips that George compiled and actually got from some private collections that really showcase Susan's acting on virtually every TV show you could imagine watching in the 60s and 70s, save for the monkeys. So I know me and Jeff can't stress enough how great this documentary is. And like I said, if you're at all a fan of 60s and 70s TV, this is definitely a documentary worth checking out.
Absolutely.
And of course, if you're like me, a fan of Green Girls, because that that episode of Star Trek has always stuck with me.
She's very memorable, and the still shot of the Orion slave girl was featured in the credit sequence of many, many, many episodes of Star Trek. So Susan Oliver's face was included in most Star Trek episodes, and I just want to for a minute take a addition to Craig's comments about the documentary. And when I walked out of that theater after having seen it for the first time, I was amazed by how much I actually learned about Susan Oliver's career. And I feel like I should have known more about her prior to seeing this movie, because she was in so many different things. She was such an accomplished actress and aviator. And she directed an episode of MASH, which I really love. So, yeah,
one of the only female directors of that show.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, she was so prolific. And I feel like, you know, George has done her a great service putting this documentary together and getting her story out there. And I think that even if you're not a fan of 60s and 70s television, just to see a pioneering woman, you know, coming up and you know, paving the way for other female directors, it is absolutely brilliant. And you know, definitely take away a moment to go look at the greengirlmovie.com and check this out.
It's on VOD. It's also available on DVD. And check the screening section, because like we went to a screening in Las Vegas, George has sort of been traveling around the country with this movie and hosting screenings with Q&As at the end in select cities. So I think there are a couple more of those coming up.
Awesome. Yep. So we want you to check it out, learn about this great pioneering woman, and it never hurts to look at a green girl.
Yes.
Because that's groovy, man. Go green. Today on Zilch, author Fred Velez will drop by to talk about his book, A Little Bit Me, A Little Bit You, The Monkees from a Fan's Perspective. But first, it's time to fire up the TV and take a look at the Monkees color cast commentary for what episode?
Monkey See, Monkey Die.
This sounds like a good one. You guys excited?
Oh, totally.
I can't wait. And we'll catch you guys on the other side.
Right on.
This TV goes back through time and space, so...
Hey, wait a minute, guys. You know what? It's 7:30, 6:30 Central Time. It's time for the Monkees. I wonder if anybody around here's got a television set.
Hi, friends. Ralph Williams, one of the world's largest...
Baloney. Perhaps not.
What we wanted to play was, Cribbage.
Cribbage? How do you play cribbage?
Holy cliffhangers, Batman.
The Monkees. Brought to you by... Kellogg's.
K-E-L-L, all double good. Kellogg's best to you.
Tonight's Monkees Color Cast commentary is brought to you by April's Laundromat. Now open 7 days a week. See April to get your suds half off. Open 7 days a week, convenient to the beach in Malibu.
And here we are back for our second installment of the Monkees Color Cast commentary. I'm Craig Cohen, and as always, I am joined by Monkey Magic author Melanie Mitchell.
Hi, Craig.
Hi, Melanie. Great to have you.
It's nice to be here.
Yeah, and Jeff Hewlett.
What's going on, everybody?
All right, so as I said, we're going to be covering Monkey See, Monkey Die. And before we jump into the episode, let's talk a little bit about the people behind the scenes and some of the folks in front of the camera. So we've got director James Frawley, who directed the bulk of the series, right, Melanie?
32 out of 58.
Yeah, that's not bad.
He was also the Monkees' improvisation coach. He worked with them for about 6 weeks before filming began, helping them get the feel for doing improvisational comedy and the voices they were able to do and the characters they were able to play.
Excellent, excellent. And it definitely seems like it paid off.
Oh, yes. And I have been kicking myself since the last time we recorded a commentary that I neglected to mention for Royal Flush, he won the Emmy Award for Best Director.
Right. And it's funny. I know you had mentioned that prior to us sitting down to record. And for whatever reason, we didn't find a way to work it in. And so I want to let you off the hook for that. It was through no fault of your own that it wasn't mentioned. It was something that you definitely pointed out way in advance.
Thanks.
But a well-deserved Emmy Award there. And
this is his very first job as a director, too.
Wow, talk about success right out of the gate. Mm-hmm. And our writer is Treva Silverman?
I think it's pronounced Treva.
Treva. And she was the only woman on the writing staff?
Yep. Mm-hmm. Probably one of the only women in any position of authority on the show. There were no women directors. As we see in the Christmas episode, there really weren't very many women on the crew either.
Yeah. It's funny how far the whole industry's probably come in the time since the Monkees, and in a good way. Mm-hmm. So we got some guest stars to talk about. Two faces that we're going to see again. We've got Henry Corden, who plays Mr. Babbitt. And he pops up on another episode of the Monkees.
Henry Corden actually played two different characters, but Mr. Babbitt is the only character who appeared in more than one episode.
I see. Okay.
The only guest character who ever appeared on more than one episode. He actually appears in four episodes in the first season. He also shows up in the second season playing somebody else.
Excellent. So we'll point those times out. And then we've also got Lee Marmer, who plays Madame Roselle in this episode, and she'll pop up in Monkees on the Line in 1967.
Correct.
All right, so you guys ready to jump into the episode?
Okay.
Sure.
All right, we will start in 3, 2, 1.
Okay, this is an episode that has a lot of firsts for the Monkees. Unlike Royal Flush, which sort of stands by itself, here we're seeing a lot of things that we're going to see again and again and again. And this is the first time we ever see the Monkees as a band, actually holding instruments and playing. It didn't happen in Royal Flush. This is the first appearance, as I said, of Mr. Babbitt, their landlord. And this is the first episode in which we see Davy get stars in his eyes. 8-button shirts, the monkey mobile, the unicycles, the catchphrases, don't do that, and he's gone, and making decisions by choosing fingers. And finally, this is the first episode in which we see Peter's orange bunny jammies.
Ah, cool. Now, I apologize for not doing my research, but where in the production order was this?
This is the fifth episode filmed, if you count the pilot as the first.
All right. So it's fairly close to the, the Royal Flush was, quite
third.
Was it? For some reason, I thought it was later, but... Mm-hmm. Let me stop before I make more of a fool of myself.
That's what you pay me for.
Yes. Wait, you're getting paid?
And I want a raise.
You'll have to talk to Ken about that. So here we have the Monkees doing some character work, which is really, really funny because here it's actual Monkees really playing characters as opposed to like a fantasy sequence or something like that.
And notice that giant head in the hallway outside in the area. That's a very strange thing to have in an apartment-type setting, isn't it, wouldn't you think?
It used to scare the dickens out of me when I was a little girl. Yeah, it's never explained.
No.
I never really figured out why they have a paved courtyard outside the front door.
Yeah. So they're getting this visit from a lawyer who says that they're, in someone's will?
Yeah. An eccentric millionaire.
Yeah. So it's a little bit of a stinger that gets us set up for the episode as we watch the memorable opening titles.
Yeah, and you're seeing some things that are going to be become pretty much series staples. The guys in various disguises and then kind of turning back into themselves. And very, very cool repetitive things that are very funny additions to a lot of the different episodes, and it kind of made the show much more memorable and relatable.
I'll point out that in 1997, when Mike Nesmith wrote a special for the guys to appear in, he started off the special with a very similar scene with a lawyer showing up and offering them an inheritance if they would spend the night in the spooky mansion. Very similar plot, which they rejected.
That had to be by design, I'd imagine.
Oh, God, yes.
Now, that's pretty hard to find, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
As far as I know, the only copies that exist were people who taped it off the air in 1997.
Mm-hmm. And I'm sure we'll talk about that at some point during Zilch's run. But here we are. with our introduction to the spooky mansion.
You know, Melanie, I wanted to ask you if you had any insight into this. I noticed that as I was watching this, they have matching outfits, but the only things that don't match are their belts. Mickey and Mike have matching belts. Davy's buckle is different, and Peter doesn't have a buckle at all.
Oh, yes, he does. It's off to the side.
Oh, I didn't even really get a chance to see. It's hard to see.
You'll see it. Peter Tork has and still wears his belt buckle to the side. The most popular speculation...
Oh, now it's in the center.
Well, he normally wears it to the side.
No, actually...
Oh, no, there it is. Oh, wait a minute. I'm looking at Mickey. Sorry. Yeah, Peter's off to the side. That's weird.
Yeah, the popular speculation is that's so he doesn't scratch the back of his guitar.
Ah, that makes sense.
But he does to this day. Wear it to the side.
Very cool.
Yeah, I love this particular sequence, especially the way Ralph pronounces the word palms. She reads palms, and Madame Roselle just steals the episode. She's just constantly stealing every scene she's in. I just adore her as a character.
Yeah, it's some great writing and some great acting. It's a nice little marriage of the two, and when you can nail that, you really get some great stuff.
Mm-hmm. They're wearing black turtlenecks under the 8-button shirts. I don't know why, but it sure looks warm, and I just want them to be able to take them off.
Yeah, especially considering that the studio was probably heavily lit.
Yeah.
I love this author who has a million of these funny titled books.
Oh, yes. There's a wonderful library of Harris Kingsley's.
There's the stars.
Mm-hmm. First time. Yes, he's in love for the very first time today. That's a wonderful line.
Davy's belt buckle is a little bit different than Mike and Mickey's. It's a bit of a more of an oval. It's very strange to look at. It kind of threw me off a little bit. I wasn't sure if there was a reason why that was done, or was it just kind of a... They just had to find a different belt because Davy's a smaller person or what?
That's what I was thinking. A larger belt might have looked absurd on him.
Yeah. Huh.
So now we're going to have the reading of the will. And this became a popular trope in the 70s and 80s with video players to have a videotape well. This time it's on a phonograph recording.
I love the fact that it's on a phonograph as opposed to like a reel-to-reel, which they could have used back then.
But a much more economical to produce a reel-to-reel tape than one record, one LP of your will. So I actually was inspired by this. I may do my will on an LP.
Well, you know what? I guess from a fidelity standpoint, and you can't erase an LP, whereas imagine you have your will on a magnetic tape and then somebody accidentally magnetizes it or demagnetizes it.
Didn't you used to be able to go into some record stores and cut a demo on vinyl, or am I imagining things?
No, I think you could. It was
There were direct-to-disc recording systems, but I'm not sure if they existed in the late 60s or not. I'd have to consult with some technical expertise on that. But.
And boom, we're here into our first romp.
Yeah, I actually call this a plot-related performance rather than a romp.
Yeah, you know what? Yeah, because you actually see them performing the song.
There they are, and there are 8-button shirts without the turtlenecks. This particular sequence in front of the gold-colored curtain was one of 3 songs that were filmed in that same setting, probably on the same day. The other two being the theme song and I'm Not Your Stepping Stone.
All right, excellent.
We never actually see the complete performance, but it's cut into little pieces and spliced into 3 different episodes for Last Train to Clarksville.
Okay.
And then the rest of it's just a whole mashup of vaguely transportation-related nonsense. Trains, and there's a jetpack, and we see the guys on the carousel from the pilot. The monkey mobile show up in a minute, and so do the unicycles. But it doesn't make a whole lot of sense. It doesn't relate to the song at all. Theoretically, this is them performing Last Train to Clarksville in the library of the... of the mansion for the other heirs, accompanied only by the library organ. But
And was this song replaced in reruns or syndication?
No, they couldn't because of this. You'd see their lips moving to Last Train to Clarksville.
Yeah, I was curious about that. I'm sure somebody was upset when they found out they couldn't swap out a song.
There's only so far you can take that.
Yeah.
I love the scenes with the children riding in the dune buggy with them on the beach mm-hmm. that are coming up in a little bit.
Yeah, that's borrowed from Monkey versus Machine, which we'll see mm-hmm. Pretty soon.
I like how Mike seemed to be focusing on the riff there as he was playing it. I just like the way he looks up. It you got to wonder what was on his mind.
Well, watch Peter at the end. He really does look like he's playing the song, which isn't always the case. But in this particular sequence, I think there's another shot of Peter playing. And I could be wrong. Maybe it's already passed by. Mm-hmm. There's that darn train again.
It's the last one.
Yeah.
The last train of course. Uh-huh.
I'll tell you, Peter was really, really great at selling selling there the performances.
Mm-hmm.
It looks like he's in pain almost.
Well, yeah, he emotes a great deal, and Mike barely emotes at all.
Yeah. So I guess you get that nice balance. And I love Davey with the twin attack of the maracas and the tambourine.
That can't be easy.
No.
And he does look like he's doing it correctly, too.
Mm-hmm.
Mickey, on the other hand, sees no reason not to reach up and adjust his mic in the middle of the song.
The mic that was really serving no purpose, right?
Right. It's our foggy season. Yep. So this is where we get into the plot that was borrowed from And Then There Were None.
Right.
And we're all stranded in the mansion, and suddenly they have pajamas. We're not sure where the pajamas came from.
And Peter's got a bunny on his.
Yeah. That pajamas with the bunny silhouette was from a Three Stooges movie in 1953.
Okay.
And I can't think of the title of it right now, but I'll get it later.
Yeah.
It's a shame that sleeping caps have kind of gone out of fashion.
What purpose do they serve?
I don't know. Ask Peter. He's wearing one.
Well, actually, I remember when I was in the Boy Scouts and we used to go camping. We used to do winter campouts because I lived up in Massachusetts.
Keep you warm.
And they say, yeah, if your feet are cold, put a hat on. Uh-huh. So I guess Peter doesn't want any of the heat escaping out of his head.
Right. So here they are choosing fingers for the first time, and all of a sudden, out of the blue, we have another hand. Of course, they don't see who the hand is attached to.
Yeah. Yeah, they see what we see.
Right.
So was this an actual house that they filmed this in, or was this a set?
I think it must have been a very elaborate house set, if not a house actually, because of the great big staircase that we're about to see.
Yeah, I'm thinking of the odd design of that hallway. You've got two doors kind of diagonally from each other that are sort of joined in the middle. So it just seems like a strange design for an architect to put together.
Well. It could just be a set that they borrowed. This is not mm-hmm. the ballroom set, by the way. It does have fluted pilasters, but the design is really different. A little bit later, we are going to see the ballroom set. It's going to pop up for the seance. But other than that, they're somewhere else. I'm not sure where. Hmm. Of course, notice that everyone jumps to the conclusion that there's been a murder, but there's no body.
Yeah, we don't see any bodies throughout the balance of this episode.
Nope. That's probably one of the strangest conceits, is that everyone assumes there's been a murder, but
it's a family-friendly show.
Well, yeah. So the candlestick telephone has had its cord cut, and they are truly stranded, can't call for help. And poor Ellie's scared.
Yeah.
They're trying to scare her. This is one of those wonderful monkey magic sequence coming up, a shared imagination, when Mickey calls Davey. And all of a sudden...
I love the Sherlock Holmes.
Yep. There we go.
That's great.
See, they're so in tune with each other that they just have the same imagination happen to them at the same time. I love that feature of the show.
And I love Mickey's Sherlock impression. It's fantastic.
Could it have been a woman?
I love the hat, and they even got the accurate hat too.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And that's really, this is like really the stuff about the monkeys that I really, really love, because that's what really made this show, at least for me, different. And here we have that great gag that Jeff referenced with all the books.
He's mm-hmm. even got the books this time.
Right.
I'd scream too if I were her.
Who's whom on Ellis Island? Utica, yeah. City on the move, dining out in Greenland. Oh, this is the best sequence of the episode. I just adore this, that they patiently build this joke one step at a time. Take their time, no rush, but they're building up to just a wonderful punchline. This is wonderful.
The pigeon with the note already on him.
Yeah.
And we get a great callback to it later in the episode.
Yep.
Oh, yeah. It's actually it comes up pretty quickly, but as I said, it's just a very patiently developed joke. So there's the first punchline, and then...
Yeah. And I liked how Mike looked at the camera, too.
Yeah.
I love those giant bones.
Yeah, they found them in the closet. So it means the skeleton. There's a skeleton in the closet.
Well, that's how you do call a St. Bernard.
And here he comes.
On cue. And he bypassed all the bones.
The barrel. No way. Right. Put the barrel on his neck.
So we may not be able to get a message out, but at least we can have some brandy. I just love the way they watch him. He's their leader. There is a message for you on the pigeon. And we go to commercial with that excellent, excellent punchline.
Yes.
By the way, this castle was the same castle that was used for Monstrous Monkey Mash.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay, he slept through the gunshot.
That was interesting that you see the four guys sleeping in a bed together.
Yeah.
That's kind of cool.
One big patchwork quilt. Isn't that adorable?
Actually, it looks like two beds put together, though, doesn't it?
Because of the headboard, maybe.
Yeah, the headboard looks like two beds put together.
Could be.
In this episode, one thing I really noticed is how much Davey does with his face that you don't really notice. If you're, since he's not talking, but he really sells fear great.
Mm-hmm. Well, he was a stage actor, so he's used to playing to a large audience. So he'll definitely emote. He's not going to do subtle.
Yeah.
Not very subtly, anyway. Mm. So we're back downstairs, and we assume there's been another murder, because we can't find the butler. No, we can't find the travel writer. Mickey's calling for hysteria. But now he has an idea. And here's our mad scientist again.
Here's your Mickey the Inventor. Yep.
Yep.
Yeah. He's going to... I'd just like to point out that he doesn't unplug the radio, and he doesn't have any tools.
Pop out a couple of vacuum tubes and plug a few wires in, and you're good to go.
The title card referenced General Sarnoff. That's David Sarnoff, one of the founders of RCA.
Oh,
and one of the pioneers of television.
Oh, right.
Did he start out like that? I don't think so.
This is probably my favorite gag of the entire show. This makes me crack up every time. I love the yes, I do thing.
Yeah.
I don't know why, but it just the final yes, I do just cracks me up.
This is a running gag in the series. They don't use it very often, but when they do it very well. And that's calling for help and getting somebody who's no help at all. Often somebody from another TV series or somebody from a historical setting that simply can't help them, but they get them on the phone and then there's a joke. Now you see, look at the green wall in the background. We're in the ballroom set.
Oh, right.
Yeah, look at that.
Green wall, gold curtains, and those fluted pilasters. That's the ballroom set. I don't know why they moved to the ballroom set for this one scene, but they do.
Just a slight redress. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And this is a wonderful scene where she keeps getting the wrong ghost. And at one point has to ask somebody to please get off the line. Because her crystal ball is a party line. So she really plays the balance between authority and scared. And you realize that she may be somewhat of a charlatan, but she's also the real thing. She's actually capable of reaching spirits.
Yeah.
But
I love
she's
the Christmas
terrified
Carol
of them.
Yeah. I love how they tie in the Christmas Carol and the ghosts.
I love knock twice for yes, knock four times for no. Like, boy, that's efficient. Will you please get off the line?
Interesting lamp choice there as well with the fruit and the leaves on it.
Yeah,
kind of a stained glass lamp.
Yeah, it's completely out of style for the rest of the mansion, but it's probably what they had lying around for the because now they're back on their normal soundstage, wherever it was they were before. And so they just had a gaudy Tiffany lamp to throw up on over the table. Oh, and then she's gone.
And now they have luggage.
Yeah, they went back to bed. It was, you know, after all that, they just went back and got another night's sleep. But it's morning now.
And I like how the guys are taking their piano.
Well, yeah. Because I speculate they took that organ with them and sold it. Because we never see it again. And in the very next episode, their rent is only 2 days late.
Yeah, so they must have gotten some money to pay their rent.
And I love how Mike had his guitar with him there.
Well, yeah. He conjured it. So this is a proper romp. There's no performing to speak of. They're just goofing off. Lots of random stuff. But that black jumpsuit that we just saw Mike wearing, there it is. See the woman run right past him? That's from a Yardley Black Label commercial.
Oh, wow.
In the commercial, that very same sequence, it's the exact same film. The woman runs past Mike, and she runs straight to Davey, who's wearing the proper cologne.
Ah, neat.
Now we're suddenly in the orange wetsuits. I just don't get this.
Yeah, this whole romp for me is just very weird.
Well, they are playing, and I refer to this as a playful romp rather than a narrative romp, because basically they said at the beginning of it, hey, let's try to cheer ourselves up.
Yeah.
And so they're just playing around, you know, with various costumes. I love this bit where Mickey's walking around in circles and then Peter wiggles his finger. You can see sometimes in the background that Mediterranean-style mansion that they're visiting is nothing like the dark, stormy castle that we saw in the bumper coming back from commercial.
Yeah, on water's edge, too.
Yeah, now they're in the middle of a town.
And they're shooting with a guitar. Mickey shot them down with a guitar.
Well, guitars get used as guns a lot in this show, mostly guitar cases, but there's a lot of examples of them walking in someplace with a guitar case and people assuming it's a gun. So, but it does look like they're having fun. Of course, notice that there's no sign of Ellie. Presumably she's just sitting on the porch watching the guys goof off.
Do you see the bottom of someone's feet on a TV show?
Well, at least twice.
That monkey pyramid was pretty impressive.
Yeah. And the fact that he did it with a guitar and the guitar didn't get broken.
Yeah.
Okay, back on the porch and...
There's an extra ghoul.
Somebody miscounted, which means they had an extra 8-button shirt. Gene Ashman must have made 5 of them.
And you know, for continuity purposes, that's really cool. They come out of a romp with masks that they were using in the romp. So it kind of ties the romp more into the episode itself.
True. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I would speculate that the mask sequences were done right there the same day. The wetsuit stuff was probably done on a different day in a different location.
Right.
And now we see where that big ugly monster hand came from.
Yes, and it turns out this whole thing was a ruse to scare her from keeping the mansion.
Yeah. Now here comes the part that makes me feel a little uncomfortable, and that is Mickey's been working on knockout pills.
Yeah, for what purpose?
He's been experimenting with knockout pills. Now you all know what it's called when somebody slips a knockout pill into a drink?
A Mickey.
Yep,
that's a Mickey. Right, slipping him a Mickey. And that's exactly what Davey's about to do, slip him a Mickey. Now he had to teleport into that suit of armor. There's no way he could have gotten into that party unless he teleported in. Fast Relief, that's inspired by an Anison commercial.
Mm-hmm.
That was a Anison slogan. And, nope, he's out again. But Peter doesn't know what's going on, and he talks too loudly. I love this sequence. It's just so perfectly timed.
I like how something like watching someone through a keyhole is kind of relative to the time, because you can't really do that anymore.
So here comes the next one. Hey, I think I've got something here.
Yeah, it's great gag. Fancy. Great gag.
Now watch what Mike does when Peter's waving his hand around. Watch Mike. He pushes
it away.
He doesn't want to get out. He doesn't want to get shot. That's great.
Yeah, he's just being careful. You never know.
And wow, we've pretty much worked our way through this episode.
Pretty much, yeah. Except for the Ghost of Christmas Past.
Mickey picks Davy up.
Yeah. Now, there is something coming up in the tag scene that I think is worth noting. We're about to see a police detective ask the guys what they're doing. And he's an African-American actor. Fellow's name is Vince Howard.
Okay.
And I think it's pretty progressive for 1966 that they have a white patrolman but a black detective.
Oh, yeah.
One of maybe a half dozen black characters in the entire series. Quite often there are African-Americans in the background, crowd scenes, party scenes, but there aren't very, very many black characters, and he's one. Yeah.
And you get one more book title gag on the way out.
Yeah, right. So there's the Yardley Black Label next to their faces in the closing credits, because they use that little clip from Yardley. That was one of their sponsors.
Ah, right, right. Okay. So do we want to attempt and come up with a MVM, Most Valuable Monkey?
Well, I certainly hope so.
All right. Do you want to go, Melanie?
I do.
Okay.
I'm going to give it to Mike Nesmith for the scene in which he not only nailed every bit of that very long joke, but did it while working with two live animals.
Excellent point. Jeff?
You know, it's a tough choice for me. I think I'm going to have to go with Mickey on this episode, because he just made me laugh the most. I love his Sherlock impression. I love the inventor scene, and I really enjoy the knockout pills gag. And I think Mickey, for me, brought the most laughs.
All right. Fair enough. And I am going to go with Mike Nesmith as well for the reasons that Melanie mentioned, but also it really just felt like Mike was really into this episode for whatever reason for me. He seemed really really tuned in with it, and I got a lot of enjoyment out of watching his performance, not to say that they all didn't do great. So those are our Most Valuable Monkey votes, and make sure to let us know on the Facebook page who your Most Valuable Monkey was. So, guys, that brings us to the end.
Woohoo! Yep.
And we will see you next time when we'll be covering Monkey vs. Machine.
Thank you for tuning in to tonight's Monkey's Color Cast. I'm your announcer, Ghosty Timmers. Now, back to the show.
Hi, Zilch fans. This is Melanie Mitchell. Be sure to check out my book, Monkey Magic, a book about a TV show about a band. It's a lighthearted review and companion for the TV show that made the 60s fun. The paperback is available online from Amazon or Barnes & Noble, and the ebook can be bought anywhere that fine ebooks are sold. Check out the Monkey Magic Facebook page, follow me on Tumblr at bluemoonalto.tumblr.com, and listen for my contributions here on Zilch, a Monkeys podcast.
Another excellent Monkeys Color Cast commentary. Hi, Sarah. How are you doing?
Hey, Ken. I am doing fabulous.
What'd you think of that? That was pretty cool.
I love that recap. And I always love Craig and Jeff and Melanie, their commentary on the episodes and all the lovely behind-the-scenes stuff they give you. It's wonderful to, like, watch the episode and have these hardcore Monkees geeks telling you all this behind-the-scenes scoop.
And if you're listening to this show, you're a monkey geek.
Yes, and I mean that in the best possible
way. That's right, because I'm one too.
Woohoo!
Now, speaking of monkey geeks, I've noticed the shirt you're wearing.
Yes, this is one of the ones from the incredible Jamie Hitchcock, who actually will be featured on my fandom roundtable that will be coming up in the not-too-distant future. It's called Why Can't I Fly? Mm-hmm. And it is just the most adorable cartoon of our four monkey men all flying around in various ways, except for poor Peter, who just can't quite get off the ground. It's absolutely adorable, and I hope we put a link to the shirt in the show notes.
It definitely will be in the show notes. we have a little feature of things that you should check out or merch you should check out. And this is one of the first things that we put in there. And there's my art, and we're going to have some other stuff. Jane Alexander is going to have an Etsy store. And these are just things that we think that you would dig as Monkey fans. So this is definitely something that you folks should check out. And I want to have her on the show and talk about her and Monkey art down the road.
I would love to hear that conversation.
Oh, you will. You might even be involved. So there you go. Well, today we're going to have an interview with Fred Velez, and you've been in Monkey fandom longer than I have. It's weird because I've been a Monkey fan probably longer than you've been alive, but I've not really been into Monkey fandom, meaning that I didn't like go to conventions and go on Tumblr and all that stuff. And it really wasn't until this podcast that I kind of got into Monkey fandom proper, I guess. And you're one of the people that I'm counting on to help steer through the seas of Monkey fandom, if you will.
Oh, and, you're in trouble.
Yes, I know. But Fred Velez is somebody who, you know, pretty much he's one of the Monkey fans, wouldn't you say, Sarah?
Fred Velez is amazing. I think I probably saw his name for the first time in probably Christmas 1987, I want to say, because I bought the book Manufactured Image, which is written by Maggie McManus, as well as Bill Chadwick and Ed Riley. And actually, Ed is involved on the Zilch Facebook page from time to time, which is really cool. And Fred actually included some photos of his memorabilia in this book that came out back in the mid-80s. And I remember seeing his names on a lot of the photos and then reading the things that he wrote about the Monkees over the years in print sources and then on monkeys.net. And I just thought, you know, this guy seems really neat and really interesting. And he lives in New York City, so he like has met all of them multiple times. He's like sort of the biggest and best of the Monkees fans that is still kind of involved in the community on an ongoing basis. I got to meet him at the first convention I went to, which was actually just in 2014. That's the first time I was able to go to a Monkees convention. And he is every bit as nice and funny and good-natured as he seems on the internet. And that is a very rare thing.
Very cool. Well, enough of our yakking. Take it away, Fred.
This is Fred Velez, and you're listening to Zilch, a podcast full of monkeys.
And joining us today is friend of the show, author Fred Velez. How are you today, sir?
I'm fine, Ken. Hi, everybody. Hi, everybody in Zilchland out there.
This is the first time you've really got to actually sit down with us, and it's really nice to have you here. And I've dubbed you the ambassador of Zilch. You go everywhere, you see everyone, and you tell people about the show as well. You seem to have been at a lot of great events. You know, whenever the Monkees are coming to your town, Fred's not far behind. So be on the lookout for Fred. You've written a book. Fred, what's the name of your book?
My book is called A Little Bit Me, A Little Bit You, The Monkees from a Fan's Perspective.
Now, how did you come to write this book?
For years, because of all my experiences with the Monkees, a lot of friends and colleagues have told me, Fred, why didn't you write a book about the Monkees? You have all these experiences. One reason or another, I never got around to doing it. Then after the unfortunate passing of Davy Jones in 2012, I thought, now's the time to write the book, to get all these stories out and let the people, you know, find out what's been going on, you know, in Fred Velez's little world connected with the Monkees.
And this isn't just your story. This is basically the story of all of us fans, and how we interact with the Monkees and with one another. What is your book about?
Exactly correct. It's about how the Monkees were so much a part of the lives of the fans, not just mine, but also other fans as well. Because it's not just my stories in the book about my interactions with the group, but also the stories from other fans, like Helen Pantuso, Dave Alexander, several other people like that. Some who have actually gone on to work with the Monkees, how much the Monkees were a part of their lives, how, you know, the records and the TV show and the concerts and all that, how it all interconnected with all the fans that have followed the group all these years.
Before the band ever played one note or sang in one recording studio or filmed one bit of film for the TV show, before they were even hired, do you think that they could ever imagine what they would have created, that it would have lasted and lived this long, and that it will actually outlive them. Do you think that they could have ever realized that?
I don't know. You know, I don't think they foresaw it to that extent. To them, I think it was just a job when they initially signed on to it. It was a TV show. They were excited about it. They had a chance to make some records. And I don't think they foresaw the phenomenon it was going to become. I mean, probably Davey was probably the closest because, remember, he was on the same Ed Sullivan show that the Beatles debuted on in 1964. And he got a glimpse of that. And I think I'm sure he said to himself, boy, I'd like to get a piece of that. How was he to know that in 2 years he was going to experience the same thing the Beatles were going through at that exact moment?
And it seems like the band has always been very gracious, because there's been times when they've been in demand and times when they simply have not been in demand by the public. They've always appreciated the fans that showed up during those lean years. It kind of kept them going when nobody else seemed to want to hear from them. The Monkee fans were still there.
That's very true. I remember when Peter Tork first started reemerging in the late 70s, early 80s, I was one of those group of people that went to see him at these small clubs in the Greenwich Village, and he appreciated that. He appreciated these people coming to see him, and he never forgot that. Even today, when I see Peter, we always say hello. We have, you know, and we reminisce a little bit about those times. The same with the other Monkees. They really appreciate the fans being there when they weren't in the spotlight, when they weren't in demand. I know Davey enjoyed it. He was always very gracious with the fans. The same with with Mickey and Mike. The Monkees were one of those groups that remember what the fans did for them, and really, you know, go all out to please the fans as best as they can.
Now, how did you become a Monkees fan real quick? Just kind of give us your Monkees story.
Well, I actually got into the music before I actually saw that I even knew there was a TV show. Because at the time, and I chronicle this in my book, I was a big fan of Gilligan's Island. And Gilligan's Island, at one point, was on at the same time on a different network opposite the Monkees. And once Gilligan's Island was pre-emptied, I changed the channels and there was the Monkees. So you mean I could have been watching this all this time instead of Gilligan? No.
Uh-huh.
But going back, that I listened to the music before the show. I heard their music on the top 40 radio stations at the time, like WABC and WMCA and all those stations back then, and I'm really enjoying the songs. And I won the second album, War of the Monkees, at a boys club a street fair during a mouse race. Put my little quarter on my mouse, the mouse won, and I got the record. So, and that was my first Monkees album, and I just fell in love with the music right away. And then later on, when I discovered the TV show, I fell in love with that too. I've forgiven Gilligan after all these years. I gave him a pass.
Tell us about the first time you saw any of the Monkees live.
First time I saw them was in 1976 when Mickey Dolenz and Davy Jones, along with Tommy Boyce and Bobby Hart, performed as Dolenz, Jones, Boyce, and Hart at the Riverboat Club at the base of the Empire State Building in New York City. And I saw them with my sister and my friend, Jerry Beck, who is well known as an animation historian today. He was as big a Monkee fan as I am. It was just a thrill to see Mickey and Davy for the first time in concert, the first time seeing any of the Monkees in concert. I think that was the experience of many fans at that point.
Uh-huh.
And then later on, when they played the Calderon Concert Hall in Long Island, I went to see them there too. Then a year later, Mickey and Davey returned to the riverboat on their own with Coco Dolenz with their show, and it was just, you know, as much fun as it was the previous year.
Tell us the first time you met Peter Tork.
Peter Tork, I met for the first time around 1980. He was coming back into the spotlight. He had done like a surprise concert at CBGB's, which unfortunately I didn't go see, but I did get to see him at some clubs in the village, like the Bitter End and Speakeasies. It was me and a group of other friends who went to see him and enjoyed the shows and that he got to know. Then I formally really got to know Peter when he made an appearance on the Uncle Floyd Show, which was a very popular kiddie comedy show, sort of a takeoff of the old kiddie shows of the 1950s and 60s. And Peter Tork used to, on Uncle Floyd, they used to have musical guests like Jan and Dean.
Smithereens.
The Ramones. Folks like that.
Uh-huh.
And Peter was one of the guests. And when Peter made his second appearance on the Uncle Floyd Show, I had friends who work at the Uncle Floyd Show, and they told me to come down that Peter was going to be there. So I went there with my Monkees Mattel hand puppet, a copy of the Australian Monkey Mania album. Peter performed a couple of songs on the show, and Uncle Floyd did a short interview with him, and then he brought me on camera to formally meet Peter on camera, which was so much fun and definitely a thrill in my life. And Peter was very gracious about it. He was fun. He had a good time. And that was my first time really getting to know Peter.
You also got Davy Jones on the Uncle Floyd Show, correct?
What happened was in 1984, Davy Jones was coming to the United States to do some business. Maggie McManus of the wonderful and late lamented Monkey Business fanzine was looking to help book Davy on a couple of TV shows like the Today Show and the Regis Show. And she gave me a call letting me know Davy was coming and asked me, can I make any suggestions of any other shows Davy should be on? And immediately I said to Uncle Floyd. And I said, I know the guys in the Uncle Floyd Show. I can get them on the show. So I called the director. Davy appeared in the show. It was one of the highlights of the Uncle Floyd show. And a bunch of us, got Maggie, a lot of people from the Monkey Business fanzine were in the audience. And it was like a thrill. It was one of the, like I said, another highlight in my monkey experiences.
And you met Mike when he was on a press junket for Elephant Parts, correct?
Oh, yes. That was amazing. Jerry Beck had told me Mike was going to be doing a release party for Elephant Parts at Central Park in New York City. So I went there. As I passed by the windows of Tavern on the Green, I see Jerry, and he's next to this tall gentleman with a beard. He's pointing at him and said, "It's Mike." Like that. And I got in there, got to see a little bit of Elephant Parts on the TV screens there. And later Jerry introduced me to Mike, and Mike was so nice, very gracious. He's one of those people that are interested to talk to you, that you, when you speak with him, he's looking you right in the eye, and he's paying attention to every word you're saying.
Hi, it's Annabelle Jones. Help us carry on our father's legacy by becoming a member of the DJMF today and caring for the horses that he loved so dearly. So you can learn more about the DJMF at www.djemf.com. If you want to learn more about Written in Our Hearts, you can visit them on Facebook. And if you'd like to purchase the book, it's available on Amazon.
Now, at one point, Davey was putting together a book, and I know that you had contacted him about doing some work with him, and he actually contacted you and had you come down and help him work on his book. What was the name of that book?
Called Mutant Monkees. Is the first part of the title. It's a long title. I think some fans will find it, but it starts as Mutant Monkees. And what happened was that I was working at a job that I wasn't very happy with, and I thought, I got to do something. I have all these experiences. I know these people. I got to do something, because I'm in a dead-end job right now. So I sent a letter to Davey saying, look, I'm looking for something to do. If you need an assistant or anything, I'm available. Just let me know. And I sent off the letter just, keeping my fingers crossed if something happened. Then one night I'm watching TV, and I could hear my telephone in the other room ringing, and the answering machine picks it up. By the time I get there, the machine had already recorded the message. When I play back the message, I hear, "Hello, Fred, this is Davy Jones speaking." And I'm going, And I said, he answered the letter. So I collected my thoughts, gave Davy a call, and he told me that he's working on this book with his partner Alan Green, and could I come over to Beavertown, Pennsylvania, to help out a little bit. So I booked a flight to get to Beavertown. Alan met me at the airport and said, okay, we're going down to Davy's house now. We get down there, and Davy's house, I don't know if you've seen pictures of it, it's a very beautiful little house out of the way, and I can understand why Davy, and it's beautiful countryside, very quiet, resembles, I guess, the English countryside, which is probably the reason Davy fell in love with Beavertown. Davy and Alan together explained to me what they were looking for, and they asked me if I could come up with like all the catchphrases from the TV show, and I just rattled them off and wrote them down. And then later on, Davy pulls out this big trunk and says, now, Fred, there's stuff in here I think we could use for the book. Just go through it. Let me know what you think. Because he wanted like a fan's point of view of what a fan would want to see in a Davy Jones book. So he opens up the trunk. I look inside and I see all this fantastic memorabilia and photographs and all these incredible things from Davy's personal collection. I'm saying, I just died and went to monkey heaven. So I'm going through the photographs and through the photo albums and through the little posters and things. I'm saying, David, this has to go into the book. This has to go into the book. My contribution is not a big contribution, but I think what he was looking for was fans' viewpoint for the book, so that a fan would look at it and say, "Wow, that's what I would have picked." And I was very happy to have made that contribution to it.
It must have been quite a thrill to have that happen, to go from being on one side of the fence to the other. Your book is full of memories, and it's not just your memories, it's memories of other fans and the stories of other fans, and it talks about not just us as fans, but as a community. You see a lot of art fan writing and all this sort of stuff that kind of springs, whether it be the monkey conventions or whatever. What do you think about all the creativity in the monkeys fan base?
I think it's amazing. I mean, you got fans who are artists who have done fantastic paintings and drawings, or put together a video compilation, or they put together their own books, or fan stories, or whatever, or things like the Zilch Pod, the monkeys.net, the monkeys homepage, things like that, the monkeys mixology, or the monkeys live concerts page. I mean, you got all this creativity going out there for a band that was initially dismissed back in the day and sort of are still to this day. The fans knew how important they were. That's the important thing, that the fans always knew how talented the monkeys really were. That creativity that was in the show transcends to the fans themselves. Like, for example, Dave Alexander, who's in the Monkees touring band, he was a big Monkees fan. He said his dream would have been to be a member of the Monkees, and through his working on the live Brady Bunch show and Davy Jones getting involved in that, he hooked up with Davy, became part of his band, eventually became part of the Monkees band. Mm-hmm. So, dreams come true.
Very well put. And the monkeys, they had to go from being a bunch of guys told what to do to guys that actually started to control their own destiny and step out and produce the kind of music that they wanted to do. And in that same way, I think it's great to see that in fandom as well.
Exactly. I mean, the monkeys is unique. They get put down by saying, oh, they were manufactured, they weren't a real band and all that. Folks missed the point is that this band rebelled against the powers that be. You know, you see about all these other bands say, oh, we're fighting the establishment and all that. Well, the monkeys actually did,
Right.
The monkeys actually did. They fought against like Don Kirshner and against the machine. To an extent, they won, because they got a chance to do the music they wanted to do, to have more creative say in both the records and the TV show. That's unique in themselves, that the fact that they did go out and do the very thing that a lot of groups say that were against. They actually fought that the power, as they say. Or as Mickey says, the Palace Revolution.
Well, I want to encourage folks to check out your book. And like I said, it's not just your story, even though it is. It's also the story of many of us in Monkees fandom. I think that folks will enjoy it. It's a nice read, some nice pictures of the gang and you, and it's just a fun thing to have. It's never a bad thing to read about the Monkees, so.
Oh, never, never. And a lot of photos that people find in the book are from my personal collection, so that was a neat thing to have, to be able to share that with the fans out there.
Fred, where can folks find you on the web?
Okay, they could find me on Facebook and Twitter. Yeah, Twitter handle is Fred Vell, and they could find me on my name on Facebook.
And of course, folks can find your Facebook group for your book, A Little Bit Me, A Little Bit You, The Monkees from a Fan's Perspective, at facebook.com/groups/monkeysfanbook. One word, Monkees Fan Book. So do a search for that. Talk about the book with Fred.
And folks, I could tell you how to get the book, but Ken made this wonderful advertisement by this wonderful announcer named Fred Velez.
And here it is now.
I'm Fred Velez. My new book, A Little Bit Me, A Little Bit You, The Monkees from a Fan's Perspective, chronicles my experiences with the Monkees from the 1960s into today, along with stories by other fans and how the Monkees touched our lives. A Little Bit Me, A Little Bit You, The Monkees from a Fan's Perspective by Fred Velez, available on Amazon.com, createspace.com, smashwords.com, Apple iBooks, Barnes & Noble Nook, and other print and ebook outlets.
Ken, I want to thank you for running the ad. I really appreciate that very much. It means a lot.
We feel that your book is something that folks should check out, so it's just our way of saying we appreciate you, and here's a book you guys might like. So, Fred, I want to thank you for being on the show today, and we look forward to future contributions from you. We really loved the recent Emily Dolan's interview, which kind of just came out of nowhere. You just happened to be where she was, and
she was very, very gracious and lovely lady.
Absolutely. Well, I want to thank you for being on the show, and we look forward to hearing from you soon.
Okay, take care, everybody. Hey, hey.
I always love hearing from Fred. This was great, and I look forward to hearing more of him on Zilch.
And now it's time for you and I, Sarah, to take a step back before they were monkeys, back to pre-evolution.
Ooh.
And today, we're looking at young Mike Nesmith and his song, How Can You Kiss Me?, which was on the Omnibus label, and the catalog number is 239. This is from 1965.
Credited as Mike, John, and Bill. John London is the bassist later of Nesmith's First National Band, and Bill Sleeper was the drummer, and the trio broke up when Sleeper was drafted into the U.S. Army.
Wow. Like we said, before he was a monkey, here's Mike Nesmith with Mike and John and Bill. That's quite a band name. With How Can You Kiss Me? What'd you think of it, Sarah?
I liked it. It's got almost a little bit of a Birds feel to it, mm-hmm. you know? It almost seems like... I sense some thematic similarities, especially to, like, Papa Jean's Blues. You can sort of tell that the same person wrote both of those tunes.
And I Don't Think You Know Me at All. Kind of similar in a way.
Yes, definitely.
Just imagine if Chip Douglas would have produced this.
Oh, man, that could have gone well on Headquarters. But then what would you take out? Because Headquarters is like the perfect Monkees album.
Right, but we could have taken all the laying around tracks that we now have, thanks to Rhino, if you buy all the handmade sets and the deluxe versions and everything.
Yes. And just thank made you, another... Andrew, and thank you, Rhino.
Yeah. and you just could have made another album. But
totally.
Anyhow. Well, we hope you enjoyed that. Well, I guess we'll call it a podcast. What do you guys think?
Sounds good.
Yeah, I think that was an episode that was chock full of Monkees.
And monkey goodness. And Kool-Aid. Yes. And Bugs Bunny. Thanks, Bugs. Thanks, Ghosty. Hit the theme music.
Bye.
Zilch. Take some time to monkey around. Here we go. Walking down the street. We get the funniest looks from
Isn't that dumb?
And that's our show. Zilch is an online nonprofit Monkees audio fanzine made by fans for fans. Any samples of music or interviews heard remain property of their owners. We are not related to the Monkees or any of their members, past or present. We are not affiliated with Rhino or Ray Burke. If you hear anything you like from the band, go on Amazon or iTunes and buy it. If you enjoyed the show, like us on Facebook and rate us on iTunes. Thank you for listening. Until next time, I'm your announcer, Chelsea Epstein, saying always take some time to monkey around.
Tonight on the episode, or...
Oh, wow. Oh, Ken Mills, masterful editing. Okay, here we go. Ready?
Ghosty Timmer, he sounds just like the old Mel Blanc from the 70s.
Yeah, that's amazing.
It kills me.
Yeah, good job.
Craig, why don't you read this one for us?
I would love to, but I don't have anything in front of me.
Oh, okay. All right. Okay. All right. Now you got me flustered there, buddy. And keep monkeying it around. Oh, I see you found the script.
He knows too much.
Thank you.
Well, that wraps up another Laugh Riot. And this is Mike Nesmith, Mickey Dolenz,
and Peter Tom,
and Davy Jones,
and Mickey Dolenz, reminding you to save the Texas prairie chicken.
Boom, boom.
Here we come, walking down the street. We get the funniest looks from everyone we meet.